a sugya that comes to say, you have been victorious over me, my children, and I take great pleasure in that, God says. I sent a bat kol, I sent a heavenly voice to tell you the law is like Rabbi Eliezer, but in that sugya that we're referencing now, since the Chachamim were so much in the Beit Midrash and in Talmud Torah and in figuring out the law and to make it pure and not impure versus impure and not pure and finding various ways to do so, that when they ultimately win the argument, because the Bat Kol sides with one side, the Heavenly Voice sides with one side, Nitzchuni Benai, Nitzchuni. And that Natseach or Notzach, or the notion that that Shoresh comes as the Shoresh of victory, expressed in this form that we saw in the small passage here, Lamanat Seach, Mizmor David, we kind of say, oh, wait a minute, what's the meaning of such an expression? The God who enables the creatures of the earth, of the Chachamim, to be victorious over him, will ultimately celebrate those people, and the people will then sing to him because they feel enabled, they feel empowered. So the Gemara explains, Bo urei shelo kamidat HaKadosh Baruch Hu midat batar v'dam. A person is not like the Holy One, and the Holy One is not like a person. Basar v'dam menat chino tov atziv. The characteristic or the outlook of a person of flesh and blood is that when others are victorious over him, he becomes sad. In other words, if you lose an argument, you are a bit down about it. Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but God, notchin oto v'sameach, with regard to the Holy One, others conquer him and he rejoices. Now, they bring a proof text. Shneemar, vayomer hashmidam lu le'moshe b'chiro amad b'peretz lefanav. And he said he would destroy them. Remember that this is when God saw the Jewish people dancing strange idolatrous dances at the golden calf. And Moses comes and says, Kadosh Baruch Hu, says God, please don't do this to your people. And gives them all kinds of reasoning, right, as to why ultimately God should not wipe them out, wipe them from the book. Well, if you're going to wipe them out, wipe me out too. I don't want a part of it, right? Remember Moses says it? So Moses is seen as the one who is menatzeach, who in a certain way is entirely victorious over overcoming, really, the will of Kodesh Baruch Hu, the will of God. Now, mind you, I think the source, this, again, these are drums now that sound familiar to you. Hopefully they sound like a little bit of a drum kit and not like a broken record at this point. Why do we ultimately have a source that talks about Moses being the one to overcome them for their idolatrous behavior? Because of what we've been saying about the Haggadah. That ultimately there are two stories, right? There's the story of their slavery, and we were freed from slavery. And there's the story that ultimately God would redeem us, even though we were we had nothing, and we were idolaters. Or at least that our ancestors were idolaters. And God would still save us. And so, why are we singing Hallel? Because it links to that part of the Haggadah. And we saw this when we talked about the reason why Daniel is in this part of the Gemara. We saw how deeply they were relating back to this part of the Haggadah again. And so here is yet another source before we get to the next Mishnah about Afikoman.
Can I put my 5 senses?
You can put 5 senses,
but the root of Netzach, which is forever, in eternity, which is God. So Mizmor LeDavid relate to go.
Right, you could take a different linguistic tack, no doubt about it, mindfully. In this case, that's not the shoresh, or the meaning of the word that they're...
I think it's the same shoresh, by the way.
I said why. So do I. No doubt about it. Okay, so just skip the next paragraph. It goes into a tradition about Ezekiel's vision, which they're just bringing, in this case, I think, because of the teaching of Rabbi Yishmael. And go to 119a1, the bottom paragraph on the right-hand column. The Gemara returns to the subject of the exodus from Egypt now. Okay, so Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Kol kesef v'zahav sheba'olam Yosef likto v'he'evi'ola mitzrayim. Joseph gathered all of the silver and the gold in the world and brought it to Egypt. Now, just keep in mind, we're talking about Yemei Yosef right now. Where did we hear about Yemei Yosef? Just before. If you recall, when the Egyptians came with the gift to Mashiach, to the Messiah, the answer that God gave to the Messiah, who was hesitant to accept the gift of the Egyptians, was that in Yemei Yosef, in those times, you were made a place in the land of Egypt. So just remember that. Just remember that you are able to become the nation that you are today, in other words, because you ultimately found refuge in Egypt. And not only did you find refuge now, according to this section of the Gemara, what are we going to answer? What question is behind the next passage? Think about the question that's behind this next passage. Okay, so Joseph gathered all the silver and gold in the world and brought it to Egypt. Maybe with that statement alone, you can be clued into the question that's being answered. Remember, it's late night, it's during the Seder. I'm going to argue, you know, that this was indeed this late night conversation. Somebody brings up, can I ask a question? They're still awake, they're still going. Doesn't matter that it's after the meal. Right? Can I ask a question? Think about, what's the question this Torah came about? Shenemar, v'ilaket Yosef et kol hakesef hanimtza. And Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan. Ein li eila sheba eretz Mitzrayim v'sheba eretz Canaan. But I really only see that I can prove that it was really the money in Egypt and Canaan that they brought down to Egypt. I'm on 119a1. V'shar aretzot minayin, where are you learning from that he had all the money in the world come down to Egypt? In other words, that people from all around different places beyond Egypt and Canaan came to Yosef to spend a little of their cash. Talmud Lomar, the Torah states, V'chol ha'aretz ba'u Mitzrayma. When it says V'chol, I learned that it's an expansive version of who's really coming to do some business with the great Joseph and the great Pharaoh's storehouse. And Joseph then creates this gold and silver trail of gold and silver into Egypt. What's the question so far before turning the page? What are they talking about? Who brought up what question? Rav so-and-so is at the Seder, and he's praising God, and he's saying, God, you took us out, and we're so lucky, we're redeemed, we're feeling glorious, we know it's because ultimately you want us to be righteous, and what's the issue? Doesn't somebody at your Seder say this?
We took all their money.
but didn't we steal all their money? Weren't we gonifs? Just like, and the people who are bitter about it, and bitter about the Jewish people, and just like us.
So anti-Semitism is already there.
Self.
Clearly they gave it to us.
Clearly, here's the deal. I don't know that they gave it to us.
We gathered them.
We But we were part and parcel of amassing the wealth to begin with. The Gemara's tradition is that we were very much involved in not only helping Pharaoh administer and create the businesses and the systems to actually deal with all of the food and the great sale that needed to go on, because Egypt figured out how to actually amass this amount of produce and amount of provision in a time that right, matan matan and marketplace demand would ultimately bring people to Egypt to do business there, right? We were granted Goshen. We were reminded of that in that midrash that we read before about Egyptians and with the Messiah. We created an entire community. For sure we amassed wealth during those times, and there were great Jewish families who had wealth. You don't have to look farther than the 20th century and the great disaster in Europe to understand what kind of wealth transfer there was, quote unquote, under the law by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, right? There was a great wealth amassed by the Jewish people who were in partnerships with all kinds of business people who had independent businesses. And so when the challenge of thinking about the wealth of the Midbar, the wealth of the desert, the wealth that you need, the metals, the precious metals you need, people say often, where do they get this stuff? Where do they get this stuff? We know exactly where they got this stuff. The answer is straightforward. They lived in Egypt long before that. They had households that amassed wealth. They knew how to do business in Egypt, and they were granted the permission to do business in Egypt long before the slave generation, long before, even if it was one generation. Yosef and the family, with the Pharaoh administration, with the Pharaoh's administration, who did recognize them as much as Pharaoh who said hello to Jacob, let them settle in Goshen. When they did business, they did real business. And Yosef, do you think he as a government official did not rake in the wealth at the time? I mean, so this kind of question, I think, quote unquote, troubled the rabbis of the Gemara as well. Or they entertained the question. They realized, and I think this is why it comes at this point, because we're almost done with the Masechta. We're at 121, we're done. So, the Haggadah did not tell that story. So let's also talk about the ethical implications of a question that ultimately arises when we think about the unfolding story of our moving there and moving out of Egypt. Now, what's going to be fascinating about the whole issue, even while that's the case, is that there's going to be a little bit of playing around with this abundant wealth as a tool that God grants peoples of the earth, including us, to use in order to establish our nationhood and then to cause a great transfer thereof in the annals of history as it unfolds on the face of the earth, people to people to people to people. Now, I think what's going to go on there, foreshadowing, is that there's a parallelism between the great Hallel. Remember the psalm that said, I took you out of Egypt, and then I brought you to the land, and then you had a war with this king, and then you had a war with that king, and then you had a war with this king, and ultimately you inherited Israel. Remember that? That's the great Hallel, Kilei Olam Chasdo. The parallel to that psalm comes in a discussion about the wealth that we've now just mentioned, so that the Jewish people will ultimately have the wealth for a while, be able to establish their peoplehood, be able to establish their nationhood, but we will see through the eyes of Chazal that money and wealth is simply a tool that is granted any given people at any given point in order to build what the so-called most redemptive situation in the world is for any given one people or another, and that is the nation state or the empire, which ultimately is not end game redemption. And that wealth transfers and people kind of have it and hold on to it at a given point in history. It's an interesting economic reality that's going to come to light here. As we read it, it will become clearer, I think, in terms of what I'm saying, how they're seeing the wealth that's just been discussed. Because obviously we know right now it's going to turn and say, the Jews took it with them. But then what happens to it is that it gets transferred. That transfer, in terms of the Gemara's expression of it, sounds like another expression of that great Hallel psalm. And my read on it, which I want you to think about and see if you agree or you disagree, my read is that it's because, ultimately, we did hear about what ultimate redemption could ultimately be, or we're talking about the context of Seder and ultimate redemption, and so we're not counting on wealth to be the tool of ultimate redemption. Somehow wealth cannot be the end game. So I think that that's why the Gemara is going to deal with it the way it does in the passages we're about to read now. Let's look at it.
We also, that was part of the story, that they got all the chariots and all the gold as a result of the drowning in the...
Right. We said that last week, right?
Right.
So that was another place that they did take it, and they took that from the spoils of war. So that added to it.
That actually is morally correct, then.
A little bit more than, say, the taking it with them for back wages, which is another trope of other midrashim.
If they took it for the nation interest, not for a private interest.
Did the rabbis ever confront you with an issue of recognize the Avadim Kinu story has everything in a very, in the light of a class of people who are property less. Do the rabbis ever confront the situation of the Israelite community being an established community with property that, in effect, was sold when they left? In other words, that the gold and silver was payment for what was left behind, or they never addressed the fact that there could have been any property owned.
Well, here is where the rabbis address that property definitely was, quote-unquote, owned, and they took it with them. We're about to read that line.
No, I mean it wasn't taken.
No, so...
I mean, like in a real estate effect, the property.
Yeah, I don't know about the property. They're definitely talking about movable property here.
Yeah, no, that they took with in them. Terms, I don't know what was left behind.
In terms of any kind of what they are being compensated for when they take other wealth from the Egyptians, it's mostly for wages that it's addressed, but it's an interesting question as to whether or not there's a source that deals with compensation for real estate. I'm not aware of one, but we should look. Okay. So go to 119a2 now. U'chashe'alu yisidra'el mimitzra'im te'eluhu imahem. When the Israelites went up from Egypt, they took all the money with them. She'ne'mar, as it stated. V'inatlu et mitzra'im. And they emptied Egypt. Rav Asi Amar, Rav Asi says, Asa'uha kimetsuda zo she'en badagan. So he says, oh, they made Egypt like a trap that doesn't have any more kernels of wheat or seed. Really, grains of cereal. Toasted grains of cereal. And as the commentary says, ultimately it's the notion that a trap has little grains in it in order to catch birds, pheasants. Other traps are also discussed that they have some type of food in it. You know, our classic one is the mouse trap. You know, people have a different Torah. My Torah is it's got to be cheese, and this one's Torah is it's got to be peanut butter. But we're talking about certain kinds of hunting methods, and they made Egypt like the trap that doesn't have anything left. There's no reason to stay there. There's nothing to entice you. Isn't that interesting, though, how that works? Because if he's saying it's like a trap that has nothing in it, we do understand how much our taiva, how much our yetzer hara, how much our desires could have played into keeping us there. And we know that from the Torah. What did the people complain about in terms of leaving Egypt?
There's no more onions.
There's no more meat. So they made it like there was nothing left there.
Yeah, but before it was the Mitzudah with the wheat. Because everybody came there, so it's just...
Yeah, yeah, in the early times it was full of that, and it trapped everybody in, and it got all their wealth. And if we only relate it to that, if we only relate it to the Peshat sense of what the Midrash is talking about, you're right, bring us back down to earth, then it's talking about the earth. If we're talking about how it plays out in the spiritual sense, the spiritual comment on the Jewish people, you know, we have to be careful about how much we desired to be there, I think comes across. Anyway, there's a couple of different traditions in the Midrash passage. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish says, Amar, Kim Tzulasha Ein Badagim. They made Egypt similar to the depths of the sea that has absolutely no fish. And by the way, we know that the fish can talk, right, from a couple of Midrashim ago. And so it's just a place that's totally empty, and it's without any kind of food and without any kind of words, presence of any kind of words that can create a new reality. And all the money removed from Egypt remained in the land of Israel. Munach ad Rehovam was there in the land of Israel until the reign of King Rehovam, the son of Shlomo, when the kingdom split. Ba Shishak Melech Mitzrayim unitalo Mirchavam. But Shishak, the king of Egypt, came and seized that wealth from the first king of the Jews after Solomon. Shenemar, as it's stated, Vayihi b'shana chamishit l'melech Rehovam ala Shishak melech Mitzrayim. And it was in the fifth year of the king of King Rehovam's rule that Shishak, the king of Egypt, descended against Jerusalem, right? Because if we're talking about the book of Kings, by the way, from the Tanakh, great read, right? Go back, read books of Kings 1 and 2. What a time, right? Post-David and Solomon, the kingdom splits and an unbelievable kind of political, geopolitical reality starts to unfold, the story of Egypt on the one side and Assyria on the other, the two empires battling it out, and sometimes kings being idol worshippers, and sometimes they're following the words of God, and sometimes they're aligned with Egypt, and sometimes they're picking Assyria instead, and just all kinds of great intrigue, right? So really important to read the books of Samuel and the books of Kings to kind of have that historical period of our nation's state status, understand the kingdom of Israel. And he took the treasures of Hashem's temple. Vayikachet otzrot beit Hashem ve'et otzrot beit HaMelech. And he took the king's palace's riches. So Shishak does this. Ba Zerach melech Kush shenitalo mishishak. But then Zerach, the king of Kush, comes and seizes the wealth from Shishak. By the way, that's not in any text. That's simply a Gemara insertion according to the note here. It is really like a Chag Gadya. Okay? And this is where those who want to say, since you brought it up, this is, quote-unquote, the Chag Gadya story. Chag Gadya as a song is the story of nation-states coming and then taking the wealth away from the Jews. And ultimately, what's at the end of Chag Gadya? Baha Kadosh Baruch Hu. God will ultimately come and redeem the entire people. So, V'shigrola Hadrimon ben Tavrimon, and Hadrimon ben Tavrimon comes and takes it, and Baal ben Neamon untalum me Hadrimon ben Tavrimon. Later the Ammonites come and seize it, and then Ba Yehoshaphat untalumi ben Neamon. Yehoshaphat comes and takes it from the Ammonites, and then Vehayamunach ad Achaz, and that was in Israel until Achaz. But then, Ba Sancharev Untalal Me Achaz. Sancharev comes and takes it from Achaz. Ba Chizkiyahu Untalal Me Sancharev. And Chizkiyahu then came and took it from Sancharev. In other words, this happened when the Assyrian armies were beat. They had taken it from us, the Assyrians, but then we got it back. And it remained in Israel until the reign of Tzidkiyahu. Ba'u kasdim untalahu mitzidkiyahu. The Chaldeans or the Babylonians subsequently come and take it from Tzidkiyahu. Ba'u Parsiim unutla'uhu mikasdiim. The Persians come, and they overcome the Babylonians, and they take it from the Babylonians. Ba'u Yevanim unutla'uhu miparsiim. And the Greeks came and took it from the Persians. That's Alexander the Great rising. This is basically the annals of history, right? Up to the moment where they're going to be totally overcome by the Romans. Ba'ur Romim, unutla'uhu miyad Yevanim, and the Romans came and then took the wealth from the hands of the Greeks. V'adayin munach Romi. And all the wealth now is in Rome. So I saw in that, I'm wondering if it resonates for you, again, the parallel to that psalm that we mentioned, in the sense that at one point there needs to be kind of an understanding of the annals of history. So we understand the annals of history, and in the psalm, the Hallel HaGadol, Psalm 136, we ultimately get to a place where Israel gets their inheritance after slaying all those kings and being free from Egypt. But over here, Egypt becomes only one more time an enemy of Israel, but ultimately it's taken from the Egyptians again any of the wealth. It's put into the hands of nation states that are the instruments of God. Thinking about what the prophets call those nation states, they come to be like hammers against the Israelites at the right times because of the waywardness of the children of Israel. And here it is, the Romans have it now, and they have this possession of this wealth. And ultimately, we have to deal with the fact that we don't really feel entirely redeemed. And the Midrash that came before, that said, you don't accept their gift when the Messiah is around, meaning right now we're feeling very oppressed by them, and they are in this mode of oppressor, and we can't accept the fact that this is going to be a people we're going to deal with peacefully in the future. And over here, we see that they have all the wealth that's amassed, and they're not sharing it, according to this Midrash. In other words, they have it in their hands and we don't. So with that, the notion that Kesef and the wealth became for a while the tool we used to really bring ourselves up and out of Egypt, and we created a malchut, we created a kingdom, and then it kind of fell out of our hands, and therefore Jewish people don't see this as such an instrument of redemption, that you took all this wealth. So I wonder what else you glean from it, and if my read is resonating.
So, if this is all true, it's not our money, because the Dagon, the produce that grew in Egypt around the Nile was not ours. So we had no claim for that money. We were just the traders.
I would only say that
we didn't produce it. It wasn't our labor.
But I would only say in the sense that you had whatever system of economics you had, people still were people, and certain people amassed wealth because of their abilities or their partnerships with people who were in business.
Yeah, but the wealth was Egyptian wealth, because
what I'm saying is that it wasn't necessarily quote-unquote Egyptian wealth in the sense that it only could be in the hands of Egyptians. There were no race laws at the time. So we were Egyptian. We lived there, right? So people say, just like they're Jewish today, we're Americans. Just because stock on the American Stock Exchange is American money and it's cash that says, you know, United States of America, it doesn't mean it's not ours. So there was still a system whereby people could make money, acquire wealth.
I don't get dividends from the oil that Exxon pulled out from Texas.
No, I understand what you're saying, but you can reinvest in a U.S. Treasury bond and make money on it.
Yeah, but that's not what happened there.
You're right, and I'm not suggesting that it is, except to say that they obviously made some money. The Gemara said they took it with them.
Here the wealth is really gold and silver, I think, not produce, not land, not serfs, not anything else. It's really just gold and silver, I think, yes?
You could look at it simply like that. I don't really know what all the wealth really looked like. I'm not positive. However, yeah, let's say a lot of it was precious metal.
Whatever the mining system was at that time.
I mean, shekels
may have been in certain weights of silver and gold were really in used in the trade, right?
But it's a very different construct today, because not only is wealth gold, silver, but there's the currency that's also the engine to produce it, which has an equivalent value in
right.
And but in terms of the whole transfer and the transient nature of wealth, you know, whether you look at the Native American tribes that had a tremendous amount of land, which ultimately was worth something, and then it got transferred.
Right.
And you mentioned, you know, in the middle of the last century, wealth got transferred by forcibly, you know, from one group to another. This has happened continuously, and not just, you know, 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. Right. So, yeah. So you have all kinds of articles of value, less symbolic, if you will, currency systems. Right. I'm not talking about a currency transfer, though you do get in the Gemara people referring to Korach's great wealth. You remember Korach from the Torah? He had so many locked boxes of actual precious metals and jewels and what have you that he had 300 donkeys to carry them out into the wilderness, and you know, he just had a massive amount. But we're not just talking about that kind of wealth when it comes to the transfer here in this passage. We're talking about peoples and their lands and their vineyards and their produce and those quote-unquote areas that create wealth and power
as well.
Yeah.
I like what you said. But to me, this is kind of, the message I'm getting from this is quite to the contrary. It's sort of saying that don't equate wealth with righteousness, and sometimes the good guys have it, and sometimes the bad guys have it. So therefore, if you really want to look at it this way, you can say the fact that you may have taken their money isn't in and of itself something that you are so responsible for. But I don't know if they're even going there so much.
Oh.
Just saying it doesn't matter, because what the key to me is the fact that the money was taken from Tzidkiyahu by the Kasdim, because Tzidkiyahu was a good guy, and the money was taken from him. Whereas you can say, well, Rehabam, I mean, at the time there was civil war and whatnot, that was a bad thing
mm-hmm.
happening, and you can say, well, okay, so the money got taken from them. But here it's like, whoever has the money, and that's a very earthly thing, but that in and of itself isn't indicative of your moral standing.
I think that's a very different read, and that's very, really interesting by way of what the wealth signifies. In other words, wealth does not signify righteousness.
Not at all.
Or evil.
Because I don't, to me, I don't, I mean, I understand what you were saying, and I think it stands on its own. You want to look at that with the connection to me with the Hallel. The Hallel to me is a separate story going from the big picture God creates and then sort of becoming more and more particular.
Mm-hmm.
And this is your history, and there's this king and that king. He brought you through the sea, and then there's this king, that king, and then he gives you the land of Israel as a Nachalah to you. And then, I mean, that's a separate story. To me, it doesn't relate to the wealth, because that was the contract that was going to be followed through on.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, I want to see the connection, but to me, it's not working.
Yeah. I mean, there's a third way to read it, too. I was thinking about this as I was reading it. The third way is to say that ultimately it's an absolute justification that it's all Israel's. Yosef brought it down. And that, well, in being that it was God's plan to bring Yosef to Egypt and to have this be the way that history unfolds, God ultimately is in control of the money. Don't be concerned, because ultimately redemption is in the hands of God.
So you're saying that wealth was the sum total of wealth in the world.
Exactly.
Shifted around. as opposed to there being other places in the world that were separate.
Because that gets back to Chol and the Drush, that really is all the wealth in the world that he collected, which we know on a practical level, all the wealth in the world. But symbolically, simply a sign that there will be cycles of ups and downs. It doesn't really go back to the ethical question at all. It's simply a matter of saying it's going to be shifted and transferred, and ultimate redemption is in God's hands. And wherever that wealth winds up in the future, we don't even know. We don't know into whose hands.
Yeah, interesting they left it off the way they did, instead of forecasting the future.
Exactly.
Yes,
honey?
Why can't you think of it as reparations for slavery?
Well, there is a midrash that basically goes that direction. But here, the midrash decided to go back to saying who's the rightful owner. Well, who generated the wealth? So that you shouldn't feel as though there's any question. If you're wondering, you know, where this money came from, if we had anything to do with it or not. Well, we did. It was Joseph. But yes, there are sources that go the direction of reparations. And by the way, people who talk about restorative justice, and that the systems of restorative justice can be found in the ancient texts of the Jewish people, they like the notion that it can be looked at as reparations, because if the Jewish people who were slaves are ultimately provided reparations, and when they went to the Egyptians to quote-unquote take them, one Midrash will say, oh, and they offered them to the Jewish people because they knew that they would leave with nothing, and that good Egyptian citizens actually transferred this wealth without it being fundamentally taken from them at the time. But there was this transfer of whatever they needed to bring with them into the wilderness and onto the next stage of history. Then that speaks to what some, I guess you can call it also, transitional justice is really all about. That is that when there's strife among peoples, tribes, genocidaires, and those being targeted, you need to have this notion of admitting one's wrong, transferring wealth can be part of what they do. You know, now you can get into today all kinds of plans for that, memorials, museums, everything else that goes along with truth commissions, this kind of thing. But for that reason, I think there are alternative narratives that it's perhaps not about the Egyptians being so righteous-minded and transferring this wealth out of the goodness of their hearts, realizing how much they've stolen from the Jewish people. So it's not an easy thing.
So why do you think the Torah speaks in the way it does? I don't remember the Hebrew, but the Yitzu Chaynbe name. Why? It's a strange...
It is strange. Jay's referring to the fact that when the Torah brings it up, that we'll bring the verse up. Turn to my trusty Tanakh here.
This just doesn't seem logical. Given the storyline, why would the Torah be apologetic about that? So there's something, it harks back for me to that issue you had raised about the possibility of civil unrest and just what all the ramifications of that could be. And that I'm reading forward even into this, so I just thought that we'll never know, maybe, how it all fits together.
I think where you're referring to this. Varanai natan et chen ha'am be'enei Mitzrayim vayash ilum. The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they lent them such things as required. Vaynatzlu et Mitzrayim. And our verse is the end of this verse. Vayash ilum, Rashi says the following. Ach ma shelo hayu sho'alim mehem hayu notnim lehem. So that which they didn't request, the Egyptians actually gave to them. Ata omer echad, you say, lend me one. Tol shnayim velech. And they were even so generous as to say, take double and go. Right? So that's the spot where, you know, why don't you see it as reparations of sort? That's kind of the beginnings of seeing everything as reparations. God really set up, like, as in a little bit more than even midah keneged midah, a measure for measure, that we received that kind of just reparation that was required, and we either requested it and received it and got twice what we asked for, or, you know, there are those who will say more pshat, or another way of by Yeshiluhu, that they knew that they were borrowing it, and that the Israelites one day intended to even pay it all back, because they didn't want to say it's righteously mine. And that's a whole different story within the framework of the discussion.
So I'm having a mental block. Remind me something, please. The Shoresh of Heat Seal. And because
Heat Seal is Nun Tzadi Lamed.
So it's by Nafu. So we're coming up with the emptied. I'm not familiar with that, and that being young, but why is it not that they, in effect, I don't want to say what, instead of saying they emptied Egypt, why are we not saying that they, in effect, saved Egypt? I can't think of a good way to put it. But
no, I know what you mean. They rescued or retrieved what was theirs.
What I want to say in English, just the fact that we,
well, let me see if I can
save them by virtue.
Let me see if I'm tapped into your thinking.
Yeah.
If we translated that verb not as emptied, but as we went and retrieved all of the wealth that was righteously ours. In this case, you got to talk about some verb that's useful within the realm of wealth.
I'm trying to say, yeah.
Then we're just simply retrieving it, we're not actually doing any emptying, and therefore, again, the ethical issue is off the table.
Right. I'm saying, in effect, it's almost that we have saved them from being in a situation of having stolen from us.
We've saved them from being in a place where they could be condemned for the enslavement.
Yeah.
Right?
So I'm saying, grammatically, why is that not acceptable? Because
no.
I don't know this in this.
I don't think it's acceptable by way of how we associate the root with wealth. When it comes to wealth, we basically say, you know, you empty the bag.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the verb that we use. So you empty the bag of the silver pieces, or you take out the last one.
But what pinyan is
Nasel is to abuse. That's the.
No, what binyan?
Yeah.
Like,
so.
Nun
no, not the shorish. Binyan.
Yeah, the binyan. That's PL.
Oh, it's PL, okay. Thank you. Yeah.
So. The abuse.
There is no
connection between Lenatzel and Lerokain, but there is a connection. If you take the word before, Vayishalum, Vayinatzlu, as Lishol is to borrow, and then you abuse them, you don't return it.
Well, it's really not to borrow in this context, it's really to ask for. It's like request. Sheila, as in you make a request. A sheila. I'm making a request of you by asking you a question. I want the answer.
The vayish ilum. The lo vayish alu.
No, I understand.
Vayish ilum.
I know, but the fact that it's a three syllable verb changes the nikudot to get rid of the full stop that you included in the expression of the word. So we're now in very technical grammar issues, which is lovely for those who really appreciate dikduk and the grammar of it all. So what we're talking about is the very nature of the roots and whether or not we can find more of a drash because of what we understand from these roots. And that is how the project of Midrash works, very much so. And, you know, leave it to the Torah to really bring us verbs that can be understood in various ways. The fact that we would want to retrieve it sounds right, because it's rightfully ours. The sense that we would want to save them from condemnation and ultimately relieve them of the, you know, responsibilities that they either tacitly gave Pharaoh the power to enslave us, or they themselves were involved in depleting us of any kind of wealth. So not sure that I totally see anywhere in Torah that would justify that, other than when the Egyptian wise men of Pharaoh's court say, "Let them go already, Caleb," right? When they want to in Parshat Bo, you start to see a little bit that some of the people of Israel, some of the people of Egypt, are very concerned. And then there's the whole Midrash that says that Pharaoh's wisest, especially the firstborn captains, come and say, you know, "Come on, we got to take these people, and we need to help them get out of Egypt, and quick." But he's stubborn, and he hardens his heart, and he digs in, and he wants them to be enslaved, and he wants to be the god, and he wants to keep it going, and he slays them. I think we mentioned that.
I wasn't trying to make a point. I was truly confused. I only recognized the Shoresh from the Hatzil. I don't know. I didn't know the Pito form.
So
I wasn't making progress.
What bothers me about this, and you know, I'm not a great student of Talmud, but more of Torah, is that Yosef is known as Yosef HaTzadik.
Yeah.
Correct. And this whole discussion of the money thing really... It's upsetting.
Really?
To me it is, yeah.
I mean, don't you know very generous and wonderful wealthy people? I know many of them.
Not in my situation now. I don't know.
I mean, I think that one thing...
You read about it, and
I think that one thing that makes him the tzaddik he is, if we're going to go back to Torah, right? That is, I see that God has really arranged this, and I'm not going to harbor anger against you. Right? That's what he says to his brothers, for all intents and purposes.
Right.
To me, he's a tzaddik for that. Anything else? I mean, to me, total tzidkaniyut. And the fact that someone makes a lot of wealth and demands that, and who knows how he got to be second in command. Did he say, "I'm only going to do this for you if I'm second in command, Pharaoh"? And you bring my family and you relocate them? And, you know, I don't know how chutzpahdik he was.
But this is what makes Torah so wonderful, is that we see different aspects of humanity, of different, and a person, and one of our ancestors, and things like that. We see so many facets of personality.
Right.
Can I interrupt you just one second? Because I'm honestly not sure exactly what you're doing. I want to make sure I know what you're talking about. Because it's a good, interesting discussion. Are you talking about the part near the end of Shemot where Joseph, in effect, arranges it so that pretty much all the property of the people go to Pharaoh?
Well, this is what happened, how he gathered the money, and this is the
But this is long after he's gone. I'm trying to understand why you're having problems with
Yosef. Well, it goes back to Yosef at the beginning of the Midrash.
At the beginning.
I'm imagining that Debbie's referring to the beginning of this Midrash.
Right, exactly.
And you're bringing in the narrative of Torah that maybe you're referring to, maybe you're not, but the narrative of Torah is that Yosef, right, really takes it upon himself to figure out a system with Pharaoh to ultimately amass the wealth.
Right.
Of not only the Egyptians, but according to the Gemara, the nation states. Whatever that wealth looks like, by the way. Silver, gold, or more. We're not even sure. So the problem that he would be, you know, in the mode of greedy and amassing it, I'm not sure that came through for me here. I'm interested to know why it came through for you here.
It just did. I don't know. I guess it's I'm always thinking about, and when I read Torah, I tell you that I think about the personalities of these people, and it just crashes at me how they're multifaceted as we are, and that's what makes Torah so great, that we see all facets of their human beings. That's all they are.
Yeah.
You know. But of course they have, you know, Hashem and dictates like that, and something in history. But
right.
You know, that's why I appreciate Torah so much.
I don't see here any negotiation between the Israelites, if even to go and ask for the wealth. Because after 48, when we came to the issue of Israel getting reparation from Germany, it was a huge argument among the people of Israel. Why should we even ask from them? Let them suffer what they did to us.
Mm.
Why we need to get a gift from them and release them from their evil?
Or will the reparation, which is not a gift, if you will, but for some, plainly it's felt like that. Yeah, I think the same debate.
No argument.
You could, if you were reading some of the transcripts about the arguments concerning reparations in Israel from Germany, really use this as a text to start your book. Right? You could quote this Midrashic passage, not this part particularly, but the part that we looked at the other day, that said, you know, when Egypt came and they offered. You know, very deeply felt emotions when money is involved. Let's just put it that way. And what's another part of this, so that we can move on and do a little bit more text, what's another part of this that we have to realize is that this is a really seriously emotional, deep ties into the reality that we had to find a way out. Not only do we have to find a way out, by the way, but this is bringing up the point, like, you had to find a way to get the wealth you needed. Whether you owned it, or whether you needed to ask for it, as we just read from the Torah, somehow there needed to be that wealth we went with in order to become the nation we needed to become. And you do need a little of it. And in that vein, plainly put, part of the redemption that you'll feel is material wealth. And you shouldn't be afraid of that. While it can be the point of it doesn't mean you're good or evil, while it can mean that it's not really the total key for redemption, and wealth isn't the everything, it can even corrupt you, Debbie, as you're saying, which they're going to see in Korach, by the way. They're not going to see in Yosef. They ultimately are saying, you did need some. And don't be afraid, it was part of redemption. Joseph concealed 3 treasures in Egypt, according to the Gemara, on the side of 119a2. Turn to 119a3 on the left side. Just so I mentioned Korach, I just want you to see that, yes, we're critical when wealth can really become an instrument of doing yourself in. We're critical of Korach for the wealth that he had. Osher shamor l'v'alav l'rato. The wise King Solomon wrote, there is a sickening evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches hoarded by their owner to his misfortune. So hoarding riches is the ultimate evil. One of the ultimate characteristics of Korach becomes that he's a hoarder of wealth. And Amar Rav Shimon ben Lakish, Zo Osher shel Korach, this hoard of riches that was kept only to himself is Korach's riches. Ve'et kol ha'yakum asher b'raglehem, and what God did to Datan and Aviram, the sons of Eliab, son of Reuven, when the earth opened its mouth wide and swallowed them, their households, their tents, and all their wealth at their feet. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Zem amono shel adam, this refers to a person's wealth, Shema mido al raglav, which stands him on his feet. In other words, if there's too much and you're hoarding it and you're not sharing the right portion and you're not a tzaddik a little bit with it and you're not figuring out how to use it for good purpose, then ultimately you're going to have the earth open up and swallow you up. And so this is a warning. Finally, just the description, Rabbi Levi says, Amar Rabbi Levi, Masoi shaloshmelt paradot levanot hayu maftechot beit genazav shel Korach. The keys to Korach's treasure houses were equivalent to the load of 300 white mules. V'chul hu aklide v'klipe de gilde. And all those keys and locks were made of leather. In other words, he had very special places to keep. He cared so much for his wealth that he had all kinds of great satchels and quote unquote boxes and items to keep his wealth, which ultimately and these mules, white mules who had very, very tough kicks, so that if you came, it was like, you know, the equivalent of, I'll stick my pit bull on you. Bottom line is that, you know, people dealt with their wealth in all kinds of different ways, and, you know, some just kept it in a regular good old sack, and some buried it out at a spot that you remember because you put a rock over it, and here he was, like, very guarded. And so the message is, do with your wealth what that which is redemptive, and be careful not to be like Korach. All right. Before we get to the Mishnah about Afikoman, let's turn to 119b1. As we're, again, making Seder, and we're thinking about the Seder evening and all that it's meant to be by way of a banquet of freedom and redemption, we have to keep in mind that, in fact, the big banquet for redemption will ultimately be one day, and this is not the ultimate big banquet of redemption. So before we're going to eat Afikoman and have no more to eat, we're going to just remind ourselves, or at least that's the way the Mishnah is organized. The next Mishnah is Afikoman, right? Ba'olam haba. So right-hand side of the page, 119b1, there's an episode in which King David emerges as the one who's qualified to lead Birkat Hamazon. What's the episode? Darash Rabbi Avira. Rabbi Avira expounds on the following. Zimnin Amar Leila Mishmed Rav. Sometimes he said it in the name of Rav, and in this case Rav Ami. V'zimni Amar Leila Mishmed Rav Asi, or Ashi. My dichtiv, what is the meaning of that which is written, Vayigdal hayeled vayigamal, and the child Isaac grew up and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast that day, was the whole point. Alright, so in other words, this verse is now going to be used as a verse that though it was speaking about this past event where Isaac is weaned, and ultimately there's a feast, this is used as the hint that one day, right, the Jewish people, the children of Israel, B'nai Hashem, will ultimately be weaned, and a great feast will happen. So what will they be weaned of? From? If we're talking about the great banquet of the world to come, I think ultimately we're talking about that we're going to be weaned off of history as we know it, oppression, the Shibud Malchiot, the ultimate oppression of the nations, and that we're going to make a great feast, a messianic time. Maidichti vayigdal ayad vayigamal. What's it really mean? And the child grew and was weaned. Ati Hakadosh Baruch Hu lasot suda letzadikim. In the future, the Holy One, blessed be He, will make a feast for the righteous. B'yom sheyigmol chasdo zaro shel Yitzchak, on that day that he bestows the kindness upon the progeny of Yitzchak, children of Yitzchak. Right? We don't often call ourselves, by the way, Bnei Yitzchak. Right? When's the last time you heard somebody refer to Jewish people as the children of Isaac? Right. Right. Ben Yitzchak happens when we call someone to the Torah whose father was Isaac. Well said. La'achar she'ochlin v'shotin. And at that time, after they eat and drink, notnim lo la'avraham avinu. Kos shel bracha levarich. So we've already determined that you need to bless Birkat Hamazon on a cup, right? We had that discussion back halachically. You have to lift up the cup and say the zimun for the Birkat Hamazon over this cup, and then ultimately at the end of the blessing after the meals, you're going to say a borei pri agafen. It's an added dimension of simcha and joy, and halachically it's required. So we give it to Avraham Avinu. Ba'omer lehen, and Avraham is going to say to them, Eini mevarich sheyatsami meni Yishmael. I can't be the one to bless because Yishmael is of my lineage. Right. So here's the question I have about what they're going to bring as reasons why they can't bless, because there's more than the one. You see, think about what they bring as the reasons why they can't bless. Think about whether it's the only thing they could say in terms of why they can't bless. What else could be the reason? What other reasons? And why Davka these reasons? What do we learn from them? Omer lo Yitzchak. He then says to Isaac, Tolu Varuk, take this cup and bless. And Omer lehen, Isaac will say to them, Eini mivarech shiatzami meni Esav. And maybe that's the whole reason why they needed to start the lineage with Abraham. Because who's Esav? Who's the descendants of Esav? The Ishmaelites are really the Arabs, right? These are the Christians, or particularly the Romans. Yeah, so they are the Romans. And right now, since we're being oppressed and quote-unquote enslaved by the Romans, who have hegemonic powers here in our land, we will not allow Yitzchak to bless. Omer lo Yaakov, he says to Yaakov, Tolu varech, take the cup and recite your karamazon. Omer lehem, Jacob will say to them, Einim varech shenasati shtei achayot b'chayehen. Ah, I can't bless because I have violated a halachic principle. Even though, yes, you could say we didn't get the Torah at Sinai and we didn't have all of the codes of law that Yaakov should have, though, known that he had a halacha, that he shouldn't marry two sisters in their lifetime. And therefore, he says, no, I'm not worthy. It's a halachic issue. Right. And in the future I know that the Torah, he didn't need to know back then that he shouldn't do it, but he should have known that in the future Torah was coming, and that that it would be forbidden to do such a thing. Omer lo Moshe, he says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Tolu Dvarech, and Moshe says, what? Omer lehem, Ein imivarech shelo zachiti likanes l'eretz Yisrael. I shouldn't bless because I didn't merit to actually enter the land of Israel. Lo b'chayai v'lo b'moti, neither in my lifetime nor in my death. Omer lo Yoshua, you'll say to Joshua, Tovu l'varech. Take the cup and bless Birkat Hamazon, you Joshua. Omer lehen, he says to them, Eini mevarech shalos achiti levein. I can't bless because I didn't merit the son that I wanted to have. And then there's a little bit of going on with that pasuk, and skip down. Omer lo le David, he'll say to David, Tol uvarech, take the cup and recite your karamazon. Omer lehen, David says, Ani avarech, I will bless. V'li na'e livarech, and for me it's fitting to recite it, as he said in the Psalms, according to the commentary, Kos Yeshuot etzah uveshem Adonai ekra. A cup of salvation I will raise, and God's name I will bless. So, here's the great scene, right? It's Olam Haba. It's the time of the Suda for all of the righteous. We're there. You know, our Seder is one thing, but we're all headed to the great banquet in the sky. And everyone's going to be with us, and all of our ancestors are going to be there. And look, I'm going to characterize it like this, and I'll take some input here about how we could characterize it differently. Look at these wonderful tzaddikim. Look at these humble individuals. Each one offered the cup to bless says, no, I'm not worthy. And they're identifying their own issue about why they're not worthy. Very, very much an I statement. I can't do it because I think here's the way it's characterized, by the way. And this is a little scary, to tell you the truth. It's home. Avram says, I could have kept my family together. I could have had a much bigger Am Yisrael. I could have had Yishmael turn out very differently. The whole situation. But Yishmael yatzami men, but he came out. Now, I'm not saying that the Torah doesn't explain who he was and his nature and all this. But Avraham is taking a cheshbon. And I give him the space to take his own cheshbon. And I'm reading him with... As I said before, Zakkai, I'm not judging him negatively to start out. I'm seeing what he's saying. Yitzchak says, I can't do it. I loved one more than the other. I knew that was not the voice. I can't. I won't take the cup. Not at the banquet of Hashem. Not the banquet of redemption. Yaakov says, not at the banquet of redemption, me either. I really knew what the Torah of the land was. I married that, I married Leah first. I should have said I will marry Leah first. Then I asked for the sister, and I loved her more. Yosef says, I can't do it. Because I have to imagine that Yosef's in here too. I have to imagine Yosef's in here too. Because he was written into the passages just before. And I don't see why they have to leave him out.
Well, okay, but following the trope you're going on, what did he say?
Yosef said, I should have been in touch with my father. And not made him suffer. Moshe said, I know it was from my side, that I deserve the consequence that I got. I didn't really do full tshuva. Joshua says, I spent too much time thinking about the military and the being a disciple of Moses, my teacher, and not having my own family in whatever format that was going to be. And finally, David says, I'll bless. And you could say all about it, all you want about David's life and the realities, but I am human, and I repented when I made those big mistakes. And even though we will sometimes see that people see him for who he was and all the way can't understand how this was the king of Israel, he made tshuva, and he wrote poetry, and he cried those tears, and he got up at midnight and played his music, and God says, you're the one. Now, the other way to look at that is this. David says, I'm worthy to do it. Why? Because people, you think redemption is bound up in having a kingdom and having a king. I prove to you I'm nothing but Basar Vadam. I'm nothing but flesh and blood. You could hear David saying it. But since I'm the king of Israel, and you're the ones who requested that to begin with, for sure, I will be the one who will lead.
What generation was Rav Abiram?
I can't answer that question. I'm not a...
The only reason I'm asking is there's almost a little bit of enough self-flagellation already. It might just be time for us to fight back over. But I don't know whether he's at the beginning or the end of the...
Let's see if we've got our little manual here, our map. I was not of the students of the absolute, know every generation, every sage and their generation. Use my charts.
There were a lot of them. Yeah, that's a good one.
We're talking about Rabbi... He may not be in here. What are you trying to? What are you wondering?
Oh no, I said I'm just wondering if there's this has been taught by somebody who is, as I said, a little bit of the enough is enough already. Maybe we have to just sort of stand up and.
How do you get that sense, though?
Well, because all these people are just not people. They're all taking a tremendous amount of guilt upon themselves. And maybe rightfully so in terms of what you're pointing out about what the flaws in how each of them related to family, things that they did, but at the same time, and here we have King David, who of all those characters, King David is the one with most obvious failings in terms of how he behaved. yet he's the one being put forward as the one who grabs the cup and says, in effect, I'll lead. So, you know, I don't know what the mindset is. I think the initial reaction many of us have is, well, that's chutzpahdik of King David. I mean, look at all these other wonderful yavot. Hey, sure, it was his flaw, that flaw.
Mm-hmm.
But we generally think of them in positive terms, despite the fact that they have rather dissimilar, frankly, you know, ballistic on all of them for the kind of family lives they live. But
I found one thing. What it says here is that Rav Avira was in charge of gathering the Talmudim who came to hear Rebbe's drasha, see them in and to see them out. So that would make them contemporaries.
Yeah.
So, maybe that's the way
so definitely they're all early Tanaitic. And whether or not they're the same generation of Rebbe Yehuda, or they are the one generation right after him, I'm unsure. But, yeah, so ultimately, this is at a time where, you know, Yavne and the sages, and so they're feeling the pinch of it, and it just happens very close. So the notion that there should be thoughts about the banquet of the sages to be the symbol of redemption comes not only at the early moments of, you know, Rabbi Yehuda and the Tanaitic, Mishnaic generations, comes later too, because of Sanhedrin and the whole notion of time to come, world to come. But I'm still kind of wondering whether or not this kind of banquet where people are demonstrating some humility says we should have done more. I can see it, because maybe in contrast to David, who had the kingdom and stood strong in that, and not until Rehoboam did that will get transferred, if you will, that he would be the one kind of stood up on that pedestal of the person who could really still make that blessing. Right? And maybe they wanted their own king. And it's the secret way of saying next year in Jerusalem, meaning next year in Jerusalem is the year that we should see the kingdom restored. But that would be very subversive and very not like the trope that we think about when we think about the general project of the Mishnah itself vis-a-vis Rabbi Yehuda. So I'm having a little bit of trouble like reconciling all of that. You know what I mean? Is that clear to everybody what the issue might be? That if this is a banquet that is supposed to celebrate some type of overcoming the forces of oppression, and it's expressing the hope of self-rule within the land of Israel, and that David is that symbol. At least that's where I'm going to push it after what you've suggested. It doesn't seem like something that would be taught in the name of Rabbi Ami, who is at least in touch with Rabbi Yehuda and that whole camp of rabbis. But on the other hand, they do imagine a time, either for the real sake of motivating the people in their age, or for preserving the hope, at least, of next year in Jerusalem. And I guess I'm saying, like, okay, next year in Jerusalem. In other words, here we are at the end of the Seder, we're trying to figure out what the Tom is. Again, I'm pushing that, I know, onto the texts here. But even so, thematically, what's redemption really look like? It is this great banquet of a time to come where we're all there with our ancestors.
I guess I'm just trying to understand what we're talking about in terms of all this tremendous humility. My reaction is that it still points to saying that I'm trying to understand
Does anybody else have a read on what the humility is there? Why do all these people decline being the leaders?
They didn't build Jerusalem.
Well, I mean, they failed. I mean, in fact, we failed. So
they're the only one who built Jerusalem.
Yeah, there is a certain centrality of Jerusalem that is supposed to come clearly in into focus. Yeah, I mean, it could be very well be, but Moses didn't have a relationship with Jerusalem either.
No, there's no direct connection between him, literally, Jerusalem,
Yeah. I mean, you know, it does highlight the importance of Jerusalem. And I think that's the shot of it all. And that kind of has that theme and feature of the end of the Haggadah. And the hopes expressed that we'll really see out of Jerusalem this great Torah. And that's the redemptive scene of Isaiah, right? That ultimately we will ultimately see God's Torah fill the land from Jerusalem. All right, let's, in the last few minutes, push forward. And we're going to do this next Mishnah pretty quickly because it's the part about the Afikoman. So Mishnah, it's a very short Mishnah. Maniti. Ein maftivirin achar ha-pesach Afikoman. We may not conclude the Seder meal after eating the Pesach offering with Afikoman. So if
without
you...
Afikoman.
What?
Without Afikoman. You need to have Afikoman to complete...
Right. It says the following. Ein maftirin achar ha-Pesach Afikoman. We may conclude the Seder meal or do not make any maftirin. Do not... Well, the way they translate it is we may not conclude. But if you want to translate it differently, you could say, you don't maftirin after the Pesach with the Afikoman. Okay? And what's important is that you kind of take a look at the Mishnah that way to understand what they're talking about. So you don't finish after the Pesach with the what's called Afikoman. What is Afikoman? Gemara. My Afikoman. That's the question of the Gemara. Amar Rav. Shelo yakru mechavura lechavura. So we don't engage in the practice of Afikoman after we eat the Pesach offering. What's a practice of the Afikoman? That means we do not go and join different groups at different homes or in different rooms even in our homes and go and eat some of their Pesach. So before Afikoman becomes matzah that we now think about in terms of our seders and takes on the meaning of this matzah that we eat, kind of eat on the full stomach, right? The way the Mishnah said it was, don't conclude your Seder meal after eating the Pesach with Afikoman. Afikoman being, in the Greco-Roman culture, a way that the night would end up with small groups of people finishing up and taking away the dishes and the little tables and going and then like coming over to your place and continuing to eat. On that night of the Seder, what are you eating? You have your group and you're eating the Paschal offering. So wait a minute. You had to get a group together to eat your Paschal offering to make your Seder, to make your Pesach holiday. And no, you're not allowed to go to your neighbors down the street, to their chabura, to their group who's eating and making their Seder, celebrating Pesach, and join in and eat with them. So the first way we relate to this in the Gemara is relating to that practice, which we know from that time in the world happened on great quote-unquote banquet nights or celebratory nights when banquets and eating banquets were in order. Gemara turns, though, and says, obviously there's a different way to understand this. Shmuel Amar, we don't understand it like that at all. Kagon Ordila'e Li V'gozlaya La'aba. No, what it really means is that after eating the Pesach offering, you shouldn't eat desserts such as mushrooms for me. By the way, delicious mushrooms for dessert. I have no idea what that recipe looks like. I tried to find this week an article or an ancient kind of cookbook that had some kind of, you know, last round of eating dessert, manachrona, last portion, a mushroom dish. And I couldn't find anyone who classified a mushroom dish as either a dessert or a last course kind of, you know, like in the ancient world, you could have a last course cleanser, which is different than a sweet dessert, right? You didn't always have people eating sweets for dessert, right? Cane sugar, and they did have sweet kind of honeys and things like this. Did everybody eat only sweets for a last course? The answer is no throughout history. You'll see that there's the writings about what do you eat last. And you wouldn't believe kind of the stuff that's come last. So I guess here, you wouldn't believe the kind of stuff that's come last, but you're not to eat it. Mushrooms for him.
So many varieties of mushrooms, you could do a lot.
And the young pigeons for Abba. Boy, did he like those small little... you know, like it's kind of like eating... It's not so far-fetched. If you think about how, I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but I've sat at the table with a certain number of people in my house who kind of save their spicy buffalo wings for the last course because that's what they've got to eat last. Even when there's like a brownie and all kinds of sweets that are on the table for later. Like, can I eat that now, the brownie, so that I can have this be my last taste? When I read this, I said, I have to share this at my table, because there are certain young men in my household who really like this idea, especially the fried stuff, by the way, because that way it feels like, oh, I'm really indulging. I'm eating it for dessert. You see, I'm allowed to eat that fried stuff. V'Rav Chanina bar Shila v'Rabbi Yochanan Amar, and Rav Chanina bar Shila and Rabbi Yochanan said, Kagon tamarim klayot ve'gozin. No, it means things like dates and toasted grain or walnuts.
The truth is, of all these things mentioned, we're throwing the word dessert in there, meaning sweet dates are the only thing in this whole list.
That's right.
So for them, it's
a last course.
Yeah,
it's a last course. The Gemara adduces a proof, meaning there's a brayta that comes along. Tanya, Kavatei, the Rabbi Yochanan. We have a brayta that supports the opinion of Rabbi Yochanan. Ein maftirin achara Pesach kagon tamarim klayot vegozim. We may not conclude the Seder meal after eating the Pesach offering with idiomatically include dessert, but doesn't necessarily have to mean dessert, a last round, such as dates, toasted grain, or walnuts. So in other words, that's where the concept comes, that we're not eating anything after the meal, the Seder meal that we eat, and that the last taste we have is afikoman, meaning that last course. So it doesn't have to mean dessert per se. You're not eating that piece of matzah for dessert. And what we did is we kind of took afikoman and we said, you can't eat dessert or anything else after what we're calling, quote-unquote, the afikoman moment, right? But really what afikoman meant first and foremost here was, yeah, don't go visiting anybody else. your Seder is your Seder. Be in Chavura, be in community and fellowship. Know that this is your space to be, and don't run elsewhere. And so, lots of different things to think about when it comes to this last session. And in this Haggadah, which is the Schechter Haggadah again, wonderful article, one time you can bring it to your Seder. Where's the article by Rafi Toman again? Was it a separate book that I saw? It's with some. Okay, today people colloquially refer to the matzah which we eat at the end of the Seder as the Afikoman. As we explore the original meaning of the word Afikoman and its subsequent development, we shall see that this is a misnomer. Mishnah 10.8 expressly forbids an Afikoman. Rather, this matzah should be referred to as the matzah achrona. The real name for the last matzah is the last matzah, matzah achrona. After which one may no longer eat anything, or put in other way, the matzah after which one may not have an afikoman, because ultimately of the definition that we saw at the beginning of the Gemara. That's the point here. There's a little bit more about afikoman that we'll do when we make a siyum, and we'll look at some of the very last parts of the Gemara, maybe in one or two little lessons. We skipped over several pages about demons and some other pieces of the Seder evening. So when we get together on June 7, that's the promise that we'll kind of look at the end, but we'll also look back at a few gems that come out of the Masechta, and we'll make a L'chaim. And if you can be there, great. If not, I've already had several regrets. Bobby and Barry sent their hellos and regrets to all and will not be able to join us for the Siyum. And we're wishing strength and good health to all. I don't know who's able to, but if we are able to come back around the table June 7th and have a little nosh as well.
Don't forget to bring matzah achrona.
Yeah, that's right. We can have a little nosh, and yeah, if you have any leftover matzah that you want to bring, you know, vavakasharan, please.